The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Inflation remains elevated last month. The Fed's preferred inflation gauge showed prices rose 6.3% from a year ago, while the CPI advanced in May to 8.6% year over year. The combination of rising interest rates and skyrocketing inflation is pinching consumers' pocketbooks as factories around the globe are reporting weakening demand for their products. This is being reflected in weaker PMIs here and abroad. Inflation is becoming ubiquitous. You can see rising prices everywhere you look. All of this is weighing in on the financial markets as stocks lost ground again this week as Treasury bond yields fell in response to a weakening economy. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's program will feature a special hour-long interview with Peter Zion discussing his new book, The End of the World is Just the Beginning, Mapping the End of Globalization. The message of the book is one we share. We're not going back to the way things were prior to the pandemic. Instead, we're going to see rising energy prices, high inflation, a stagnating economic growth globally, in food shortages accompanied by famine, a somber message that is worth heeding as we enter a turbulent time in world affairs. Every once in a while, there's a book that is written that is profound in its thesis, as well as being prescient about the future. Peter's new book is one I highly recommend reading if you want to know what's ahead for the global economy, global financial markets, and what is going to be a very volatile period in world history. It is the reason we're going to devote the entire show today to Peter's book. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Frank Barbera.
Well, it was the end of the second quarter and the end of a pretty miserable first half of 2022. Over in bondland, the U.S. Treasury bond market had its worst first half start since, get this, 1788. And yes, that was 1788. So 234 years ago. And yes, I did a fact check on that. Hard as it may be, the bond market with the worst first half since 1788. For the S&P, the first half of 2022 was the worst since back when John Kennedy was president and the U.S. faced down the old Soviet Union back in 1967 with Nikita Khrushchev and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Last week's modest rally in stocks actually lifted the S&P 500 performance just a bit. Otherwise, it would have been the worst first half for any year for the S&P since 1932, and that was the bottom of the Great Depression. The first half winners for 2022, well, think oil, so-called black gold, Brent crude oil up 47.6%, West Texas Intermediate crude oil up 40.6%, the widely followed CRB, Commodity Research Bureau Index, which tracks a broad basket of commodities, was up 25.3%. The U.S. dollar up 9.4% for the first half of 2022. That dollar gain coming on the back of extreme weakness in the Japanese yen, which lost 10% in just the second quarter of 2022. For the first half of the year, gold was unchanged, down less than 1%. And after that, most other asset classes turned deeply red. It was a brutal quarter for the technology stocks and a brutal first half. The widely traded NASDAQ QQQ down a whopping 29.2%. During the week just past, the Atlanta Fed slashed its GDP second quarter estimate to minus 2.1%, down from 0% growth on June 15th. And what had been a positive 1.9% estimate for growth that was seen as recently as May 27th. So the impact of surging gasoline, diesel fuel, and food prices all around the nation has sent economic growth into a full-scale tailspin. And that was confirmed this morning, Friday, July 1st, when the Institute for Supply Management, the ISM, had the May print for manufacturing tumbling to a reading of 53, down from 57 in April. And that is now closing in on the all-important 50 line, which is the line of demarcation between expansion and economic contraction. In addition to the burgeoning weakness in the manufacturing sector, we also learned recently that consumer confidence is in full-scale retreat, with the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey literally collapsing to 50.2 in its most recent release, way below the 58.1 data which analysts had been expecting. That stunning decline in consumer confidence left the Michigan survey at an all-time low going back to the 1970s and positions the data deep in recession territory, with the Futures Expectations Index the lowest seen since 1980. On the back end of the yield curve, all of this withering onslaught of bad economic data started to push down long-term interest rates, which seemed to be trying to price in a recession. As the quarter drew to a close, the prospect of a recession at hand, possibly bringing on demand destruction, has pushed down long-term rates, and that actually helped the beleaguered U.S. stock market find a little footing on Friday, with the S&P 500 closing the week out at a reading of 38.25. That's still down 86 points, or 2.19% for the week, but the S&P up on Friday just about 40 points. For the first half of the year, the S&P was down 19.74%, and again, NASDAQ down just about 30%. It's hard to believe the sheer speed with which the economic data has turned, but when you look at this disaster of soaring energy prices and soaring food prices, I guess it really should not be that much of a surprise.
A lot of attention has been paid to the baby boomers and the advanced economies and their integration into the labor force. But an even greater story played out when Eastern Europe, and particularly China, started joining the global manufacturing and trading system. And if you look at the mathematics of it, the integration of China after the granting of the most favored nation status in 2000 by the US Congress effectively led to a 120% increase in the global labor supply of the manufacturing system in the world. I mean, there's been nothing like it ever before in the positive side. So over the last 30 or 35 years, the combination of China's and Eastern Europe's integration and the joining of the baby boomers created a huge demographic sweet spot. And it was no surprise, as you would expect from basic economics, that when you increase the supply of a good or a commodity that aggressively, its price inevitably drops. And so we got a decline in wage growth, we got a decline in inflation. And that process actually started reversing sometime around 2010. But one of the key stories about global macroeconomics is, until the whole world turns, you don't really start seeing those effects. And that's really been the crux of our argument, that we've seen things from a global standpoint. We've seen things from a supply side, whereas people like Larry Summers have made excellent points, but all from the demand side, which can be better managed by central banks. Our argument is a lot harder to deal with. And I think that's the crux of the story, that inflation over a period of time will rise as we see structural labor shortages, and as the dependents start dominating the population and workers become more scarce, you get less disinflation, more inflation, which means you get hit with a structural uptick in inflation, which we're just not prepared for.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today
at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, we're all hoping that the pandemic is over. We're looking forward to the time maybe we can go back to the way things were. But the world is changing, and the real story is we're not going back. And that's the subject of today's interview. Joining me on the program is geopolitical strategist and best-selling author Peter Zeihan. We're here to talk about his new book, The End of the World is Just the Beginning, Mapping the Collapse of Globalization. Peter, I want to read something from the introduction of your book. You said, our world has gotten cheaper, better, and faster. But you point out this is artificial. It was a perfect moment in time, and it is now passing. Instead of cheap, better, and faster, we're transitioning to a world that's pricier, worse, and slower because the world, our world, is breaking apart. Let's begin with the opening of your book.
Well, that's a cheery place to start. What I do is I cover two major trends, deglobalization and depopulation. The globalized era that we're familiar with, that brought us international finance and energy and technology, it was only made possible because the United States wanted a security paradigm to fight the Soviets during the Cold War. And we invited everyone to join, and we told everyone that we would protect all their shipping at all times to all places and open all markets if, in exchange, they would side with us against the Soviets. And it worked, and that's what created globalization. But what people forget is that globalization was a bribe. And with the Soviet Union gone, the strength of the American commitment to that system went with it. And in the next seven presidential elections, we went with the guy who was less of a globalist. And that includes the shift from Trump to Biden. So that era is over. And then there's depopulation. When the world became safe because of globalization, everyone was able to move into more value-added work. So it was off the farm and into towns to take manufacturing and services jobs. Well, when you live on a farm, you have a lot of kids because they're free labor. But when you live in a condo in Manhattan, you have very few kids because of the cost of raising them, and there's no economic payout until you're near retirement, and that's only if they take care of you. So in a very short period of time, people go from having five or six kids to one or none. You play that out on a global stage, and we are at the beginning of a massive population bust. In most of the advanced world, we've already aged past the point of having enough young people to be consumers or workers. And in large portions of the advanced world, we're on the verge of a mass retirement wave without replacement generations down the line. Well, if you don't have those people, you don't have the investment that comes from it, you don't have the consumption that comes from it, you don't have the workers that come from it. So the very foundation of every economic model we have, whether it's capitalism or socialism or fascism, just doesn't work in an era of population busts. And we are well past the point of no return on both of those trends.
Now, in your book, you talk about this devolution. You talk about the geography of success. It's not immutable. A deglobalization world is going to have a different economic geography. But one of the positive things, which is a theme through many of your books, the U.S. largely escapes the carnage to come. Let's talk about that.
Sure. So think about what makes a modern iPhone possible. You have copper from Chile. You've got wiring that's done in Malaysia. You've got computer chips that are designed in the United States and fabricated in Taiwan. You have a case that's probably made in China. You have a camera system from Japan, and so on and so on. The economy of the whole, of the entire single global network, enables countries at different labor points, at different price points, at different skill sets to all collaborate on a single supply chain to make an end product. And whenever you break a system apart into so many different constituent pieces, each individual step of that process is able to maximize their economic utility and performance. Those economies of scale, that geography of success, is one of the whole. But if you start breaking that down for reasons cultural or moral or economic or trade or labor, you have access to fewer and fewer places to manufacture those inputs. So if, for example, the United States was just to pull up the drawbridge and go home, a lot of the electronics manufacturing that happens in East and Southeast Asia would no longer be accessible. We would have to rebuild that ourselves. And the same goes the other direction. If the Chinese, for various reasons, like say COVID lockdowns, falls out of the network, that would all need to be relocated. And when you have fewer producers in fewer places, the costs of all those components go up, and the chances for supply mismatches, at least in the short run, explodes. What makes the United States unique is that while we do have a generation that is retiring that is large, the boomers, we actually have a replacement generation coming up, or one of the few exceptions, the millennials. And so the United States still has the capacity to have the investment, the consumption, the design, and the production all more or less in one place, particularly when you partner with Mexico. So it's one third of global consumption is in North America. That's certainly less of an economies of scale than the global whole, but there's no other part of the planet that has that sort of advantage. And what we're seeing in the world of manufacturing and really everything else is when you start compartmentalizing different pieces of the world, size matters. And the North American continent is already well set up demographically, legally, politically, culturally, and financially for what is coming. And if the United States is no longer holding up the ceiling for everywhere else is, for the most part, in a lot of trouble.
Let's talk about these transitions that we've seen. We've gone from farming to the Industrial Revolution to the high-tech revolution. We're trying to move, Peter, to what people are calling the Green Revolution. Let's talk about this transition. It's more likely to take longer and maybe turn out much different than we think.
Start with the positive side. There are a number of parts of the world that have great wind potential and great solar potential. The problem is that that's not everywhere. That's only in a very small sliver of the Earth's surface, probably less than about, maybe it depends on where you draw the line, but about 10% of the total. A lot of those zones are in places that people don't live. So think the central outback, think Central Asia, think North Africa. However, in the United States Southwest, roughly going from Los Angeles to Dallas-Fort Worth, that's one of the best solar zones in the world. And the American Great Plains are one of the best wind zones in the world. And there are sufficient population centers in or adjacent to those zones that the United States can reasonably use solar and wind for a significant percentage of its energy production without too many changes to the grid. But in most places, the closest major wind or solar zones is a continent away. So the Europeans would have to go into the Sahara. The Chinese would have to go into the outback. And that's just not feasible with today's technology. There's also the same problem of the whole versus the problem of the many when you look at the components that are necessary to make these systems to work. We understand the agony of oil supply chains. You have to deal with Venezuela and Iran and Iraq and Russia. But if you want to go into wind and solar in a big way, you need to replace the oil supply chain with the supply chain in order to make the turbines and the panels. And that means you need Canada and Mexico and Brazil and Chile and Bolivia and Argentina and Italy and Romania and China and Australia and Malaysia and Indonesia and Sri Lanka and Kenya and Ethiopia and South Africa and, oh yes, still Russia. The complexity of the supply chains to build out today's green tech is an order of magnitude more complex than what exists for oil. So we're in this weird situation where we're moving away from the globalized system, and we'd like to have energy self-sufficiency. And by we, I mean every individual country. But it can't be done without the global system. And in the short term, we know we can't have globally available, inexpensive fossil fuel energy without Russia. But looking forward, we also can't do the green transition without Russia.
And one of the things you talk about, and this once again gets back to the positive side on the U.S., in your previous book, The Accidental Superpower, you talk about the U.S. having the most powerful river and land power in the history of the planet. Let's talk about that.
Sure. So it really comes down to transport. Lugging things from A to B is kind of a bitch, but if you float it, it's about 1/12 the cost of moving it by a semi. The greater Mississippi system of the U.S. has more miles of navigable waterway than the internal totals of the rest of the world combined. And if you add in secondary American rivers or the Intracoastal or maybe the Great Lakes Network, you're talking about the U.S. by itself having almost double that of everyone else. The ability to float things is in many ways the way you make transport into an issue of global power. And the United States used that aggressively in its first 150 years of existence. In addition, the United States' greater Midwest region is the best agricultural zone in the world. Not only is it large, not only is it contiguous, not only does it roughly overlap that river network, it also gets its moisture from two different atmospheric systems, the jet stream, which flows west to east, and then moisture from the Gulf that comes up north roughly into the heart of the Midwestern system. So it is very rare for the Midwest for both of those systems to fail and trigger a drought. So the sort of climate problems that bedevil agriculturalists in most of the rest of the world, in the United States, that's maybe a one in decade event instead of a one in 3 years event.
So in this system that we have grown up for most of our lives, you call this a system that was brought about by the order. Explain what the order allowed, because it allowed countries to specialize in things that they were good at because they could buy the things they weren't good at from other countries because of globalization and trade. And that was made possible by the might of the U.S. military. And I live in San Diego, which is home to four of our 10 carrier battle groups. We have the Navy SEALs here. We have the Marines here. We have a sub base here. And you really get a feeling for the power of the U.S. military. Explain how that is changing now as the U.S. withdraws and the order is no longer the order.
What's the other side of the coin of globalization? When we made the world safe for civilian maritime traffic, any country that wanted to play could play in any way that they wanted to. And so countries wouldn't have to simply follow the same template. Before globalization, if you wanted your population to have food, you had to grow it yourself. If you wanted to have a manufacturing system, you had to do it yourself, and you had to protect it and not integrate with potential rivals or even countries that were friendly, because if there was a conflict, even if you weren't involved, you could see your entire supply system break down, and that would be catastrophic. Globalization did away with that lack of network, and we finally got to a situation where any country could play in any way. So take South Korea, which before globalization was one of the poorest parts of the planet. The population basically lived in subsistence farming. But when they had access to raw materials and markets the world over, they started industrializing, they started urbanizing, they started getting into value-added industries, and they went from heavy industries to medium industries like toy production to ultimately high tech like cell phones and semiconductors. They then sell those products on the international market to purchase the things that they need, whether that's cement or copper or oil or food. Every single country in the world has gone down this road to a certain degree at different paces, starting from different points, but overall the story is the same. Well, we're now getting to do that in reverse. Whether it's because of the Ukraine war or a dust up in the Middle East or the United States going home and just not holding up the ceiling anymore, we're seeing countries being forced to fall back onto their own internal systems and lose their access to the wider world. In some countries, that's a food crisis. In some, it's an energy crisis. In some, it's manufacturer shortages. In some, it's all of the above. We're going to be seeing a lot of countries just flat out fail moving forward. And just as the industrialization process has dominated most of the last 70 years of history, the next 20 years is going to be dominated by deindustrialization as countries lose access to the networks and the resources and the markets that are necessary to make these systems work.
So in your book, you talk about the halcyon days of globalization were 1980 to 2015, and you say that that period is over, and it's being brought about by the demographic collapse of birth rates, which is now gathering steam. And, you know, like anything else, Peter, it takes time to produce children, to raise children to the time they become productive adults. So this isn't something that's going to be fixed overnight. And I keep thinking of China, which everybody is saying, a lot of people are saying is the next superpower. And I want to talk about that later on. But with China's one child policy, that's now catching up with them, just as having fewer children in Europe and elsewhere is catching up with other countries as well.
Demographics are a lot like a glacier. It doesn't matter until suddenly it's everything. And we're at the point where it's everything. We passed the point of no return in most countries when it came to demographic collapse 20 and 30 years ago. It takes a long time for a lack of children to turn into a lack of mature adults. But we're there now. China's an excellent example. And you see it both from a positive and a negative point of view. Positively, if your birth rate collapses, for the next 20 years, you see higher and higher consumption levels because you have a lot of young workers who don't have kids. They're able to put in longer hours at work, which means they earn more income, and then they spend that income on very high octane growth things like cars and vacations and condos. That just generates more economic growth than eking out a subsistence agricultural existence or buying diapers. But if you do it for another 20 years, then you're talking about having run out of people aged 40 to birth. And in that environment, they have lots and lots of capital because they're mature workers, they have decades of experience in their jobs, their incomes are high, their consumption is falling off. But the amount of money that they can throw into their investment portfolios is huge. And in those systems, you see high tax income and high standard of living and high technical capacity of the entire system. And it makes it look unstoppable. And that is the situation that China was in roughly 10 years ago. But you now have very few people aged 40 and under, which means it is now statistically impossible to sustain your population. And another 10 years on, and you're talking about a complete collapse of consumption, and a big chunk of your worker cadre is now aging into retirement, and that's where the system collapses. And that's where China is now. We now know from the bits and pieces of the 2020 Chinese census that have been released that there are going to be fewer Chinese, or going to be half as many Chinese in the year 2050 as there are now. Their aging is that terminal and that fast. And that means it is impossible for the Chinas that we know to survive this decade. The only question is, when does the collapse happen? In 2024, in 2028, in 2030? It's going to be very soon. And China is going to go out just like it came in, with a big splash.
Yeah, that was something you mentioned in your book. In 2022, you talk about China is the fastest aging society in human history. And you talk about we could see them traveling from a pre-industrial level of wealth and health to a post-industrial demographic collapse in a single lifetime.
China basically compressed six generations of industrial development into one. And so, of course, the nominal growth rate was impressive. But that also means it crushed six generations of demographic transition into one generation. And that means there is no one to carry the torch in the future.
So you talk about deglobalization doesn't mean a darker, poorer world, but something much worse. You describe that as decivilized. Explain.
It's going to be different for each country. Some countries produce excess food and then import fuel. Some produce export fuel and import manufacturers. But you've got to look at who is more integrated, who is more dependent upon inputs that come from abroad. And in those countries, you're looking at a breakdown of their manufacturing model, their input model, their consumption model. At the same time, they may be facing a demographic collapse. And the countries that face the greater challenges, we're not just talking about the power going out. We're talking about the food no longer being produced at scale. One of the early outcomes of the Ukraine war that we're all dealing with right now is we now have a global fertilizer shortage because the Russian space was responsible for something like 40% of global potash and 15% of global nitrogen and a significant amount of phosphate on top of that. And so this calendar year, we are seeing farmers the world over either using no fertilizer, less fertilizer, or crop switching to crops that don't require as many inputs. So this harvest season, this fall, we're going to see a massive shortage in global calories. We'll play that forward. It's not just Russia that's falling out of the constellation of the global economy. So too is China, the world's largest phosphate exporter. So too is a lot of the stuff in the Eastern Hemisphere. When you break down food and energy and consumption at the same time, you're talking about a systemic challenge at every level of each individual country. And the ones that were more dependent upon these imports and outputs, these imports and exports, they're not just looking at the lights going out. They're looking at a population correction as we experience agricultural demand destruction, which is a fancy technical way of saying mass famine. In those systems, whether it happens to be in China or sub-Saharan Africa or Central Asia, you're looking at a complete collapse of what it means to be able to participate in the modern world. And that means the rule of law goes away. That means the government goes away. And we're going to have to watch a lot of these places just break down into a system that we have not seen in the last two centuries, places where industrialization is simply no longer possible.
You talk about the world that we have all grown up, most boomers that are living today. We grew up in a world that got better, cheaper, faster. Just take a look at the technological inventions that we have. We have smartphones, we have iPads, technology, communication. You talk about what we've experienced as a result of industrialization moving to a technological revolution. That was an anomaly. Explain that, because a lot of people are still hoping that, you know, now the pandemic's over, despite the war in the Ukraine, we're going to go back to normal and things will be like they used to be. That's not going to happen.
Absolutely not. I mean, there's two aspects to this. You know, part of it is the globalization story, having those economies of scale, no one having to really worry about a geography of success because the Americans made this world safe for everyone. That commitment is gone. And even if you look at what the Biden administration is doing with the Europeans as regards the Ukraine war, he's trying to do the security side of globalization without the economic side. Now, that can work on a case-by-case basis, and I see no reason that there's not hope for the coalition that is backing Ukraine. But as soon as that war is over, economic issues are simply being ignored. He seems to have no interest in seeking a meaningful trade relationship with any part of the world where we don't already have a trade deal. And in fact, every single tariff that the Trump administration has levied on the wider world, Biden has doubled down on almost all of them. There's a couple of exceptions here and there that are notable, but that's the overall story. The second piece, of course, is demographics. We've had a balance for 1980 to roughly 2015 between countries with a lot of people in their 20s and 30s and countries with a lot of people in their 40s and their 50s. So we've had a good balance of importers and exporters, capital producers and capital consumers, and that's led to an ever more networked system. But 20 years later, we are all 20 years older. And the countries that were the income providers, the ones with all the people in their 40s and 50s, they're now moving into mass retirement. And the people who were the consumers, everyone in their 20s and 30s, well, they're now in their 40s and 50s, which means that we've run out of consumers and the base labor that's necessary to make the system work. We can't go back. If you want to have a lot more 30-year-olds and you start right now, you still have to wait 30 years. And there's no sign of birth rate expansions in any country of size anywhere in the world. So we are just slouching towards an ever older demographic in an environment where the economy gets broken up into ever smaller pieces. We're losing economies of scale. We're losing the skill sets. We're losing the investment capital, and we're losing the labor all at the same time. So when I talked about the Chinese compressing six generations of activity into one, in a way, the world did that on a larger scale, compressing about a century of growth into 30 years. And if we want to get back to that world, and we start right now, we need a new globalized system with a new impetus, with a new security guarantor, and at least 40 years to grow the people to make it happen.
So as you look at this, one of the things I find interesting, how will different forms of government handle this, from a capitalistic system like the U.S. to socialism or even to communism? How does this work when there's less?
Well, I'm going to try to not play favorites here. I'm obviously American and therefore a capitalist by definition. But the systems that we have in place were all designed for the economic realities of the last 500 years of population growth. The whole idea is that as systems become larger and more integrated, they generate more economic activity. How you manage that is up to the political proclivities of each individual country. And in the time since the Columbus expeditions, we have settled as a species on four broad systems: socialism, capitalism, fascism, and command-driven communism. They all have their perks. They all have their drawbacks. Capitalism generally generates a lot more economic growth, but at the cost of a degree of social exclusion as you get the rich versus the poor. Command-driven communism can generate much faster results, but only if the folks that are in charge of the command system are really on the ball every single day. If they fail, you get a mix of corruption and economic dysfunction. But what all four have in common is this concept of more, that the populations are going to expand, so the economies will expand, and then you'll have more of a pie to divvy up. That's not the world we're in anymore. 500 years of economic history is being unwound right now because the populations are no longer getting bigger and the whole is no longer expanding. So we're having to struggle to divvy up pieces of a pie that is actually shrinking at the same time it's breaking apart. We don't have a single economic theory that was designed to deal with what we're facing right now.
So in this new order that is developing and moving forward, you talk about two likely economic systems that might work: imperialism with a military and powerful navy, or mercantilism, three factors such as cultural superiority, military projection power, and lots of young people. So where might this take place?
There aren't a lot of options. When you're talking about places that still have a reasonably stable demography and kind of the potential to have an imperial attitude that is popular among the population, you're really only talking about two possibilities. That's Turkey and France. These are countries that are powerful within their own neighborhood, that at the moment are the most powerful within their neighborhood, and they can see things that are not too far off that are worth having. But I will point out that if you go with an imperial mercantile future, the only way that works for the countries that are carrying that out is to smother the interests of all of the countries that they want to interact with. So yes, we could have a neo-Turkish or a neo-French empire, but they will be then exploiting countries hugely, transferring all of the negative impacts of this new deglobalized system onto their new neo-colonies. It's not a pretty picture, but if you look at history, imperialism never has been.
I want to talk about a country that has had a demographic problem, an aging population, and how they handled it. Let's talk about Japan.
Sure. So Japan is the world's oldest country from a demographic point of view. They're one of the fastest aging until they were the fastest aging until the Chinese and the Russians passed them a few years ago. But they've had a few advantages that other countries haven't. Because they hit that terminal point in their demography back in the 1980s, they've had time to assimilate and study the problems and come up with a few solutions. So Japan is obviously the country that has the most automation in play, as they use robots and automation to supplement their situation in terms of labor. They've also realized that with a steadily shrinking labor force, that they will never be able to produce even with help from automation. So they focus more on the design of products, and then they go overseas to countries with much better demographics in order to actually build the product. Build where you sell is basically the Toyota corporate mantra, and that kind of reflects this perfectly. So national robot strategy, offshoring, or nearshoring if you prefer. I'm not sure that this can be duplicated though. The Japanese implemented this process over a 40-year transition period. They've had time. They were able to look forward, figure out where they needed to be, and build out the infrastructure. They also had the advantage that the United States was still upholding globalization while they were doing that, and they had the option of doing their expansion in industrial activity to the United States, who was their security guarantor. The circumstances in which the Japanese were able to pull off this aging gracefully process just aren't there anymore. And perhaps the biggest concern is going to be capital. If you want to build out an industrial plant somewhere else, you've got to pay for it. Well, Japan did it between 1980 and 2015, using that moment of global growth and activity, and capitalized on the fact that they had a lot of older workers who were at the height of their careers paying taxes. They had the capital. Most of the countries that now need to make this sort of shift have already aged well past where the Japanese were in the 1980s. In some cases, they're nipping on Japan's heels directly, and I'm thinking specifically here of Germany and Italy and Korea. It's probably too late. They're going to have to implement a larger industrial transfer with less capital in a shorter time frame. And with that, you should expect their success to be scaled back considerably compared to what we've seen out of Japan.
So let's move forward, Peter, to where we are today with the pandemic. And in your book, you said the one key thing about the coronavirus is it robbed us of time. It limited contact, which limited economic activity. It disrupted lifestyle. We saw fewer goods and services. We're still dealing with that today with supply chain issues. Those that escaped, let's say, areas of the world like sub-Saharan Africa aren't much better, but it really is hitting the supply chain, whether we're looking at baby formula now. I've noticed in stores today, it's not predominant, but you'll go down a section of a store and there'll be some empty space on shelves because the goods aren't there.
I hate coronavirus so much. it's like two years of hell. Most of my income comes from getting on a large plane and going to speak to large groups of people in person. So it was a really rough time. But yes, it challenged every step of every supply chain. A good supply chain requires people moving back and forth to coordinate steps of production. And it certainly requires production from dozens, if not hundreds, of individual locations that then move into a final assembly stage for actual completion of the product. And then it's a question, of course, of getting it from A to B, because if the product is finished in, say, Shanghai, you're going to sell it in New York, you then have a maritime trip on top of that. Between quarantine restrictions, healthcare devolutions because of so many people getting sick at the same time, every step of every supply chain system faced a degree of challenge. And that meant that whatever it was that is coming next in a post-globalized world, even for people who could see it clearly and knew what they needed to do, they couldn't get the capital mobilized and people and the workers positioned in order to prepare for that future. And at the same time, we lost 2 years of everyone continuing to get older. 2022 was always going to be the year that the majority of the rich world's baby boomers moved into retirement, or will have moved into retirement. And so the last 2 years of that period from 2020 to 2022 was essential in mobilizing labor and capital to prepare for what's going to be our new normal. And we lost 2 years. Even more than that, we saw an advanced breakup of the supply chains as countries and companies who ignored, say, the Trump administration tariff process, suddenly found their supply chains breaking for reasons unrelated to trade restrictions, but they couldn't build replacements. So here in 2022, moving into 2023, we're going to try to cram a decade of transition into 2 years in an environment of capital shortages. Not everyone's going to make it.
I want to talk about, as we go to deglobalization, what trade and shipping is going to look like, including trade pacts, because we've seen, for example, oil tankers get bigger. Shipping container ships have gotten bigger. Some of the ships that I see parked offshore Los Angeles are piled high with these containers. In a world that is less global, what does that look like?
It doesn't look great. One of the reasons why ships are getting bigger is because at the height of globalization, it was all about efficiency. So every time you roughly double the size of a ship, its fuel needs, its operational costs per unit of items to be transferred drops by roughly 20%. So if you double, and eventually get to one of those super container ships that can handle 30,000 containers at the same time, your per unit operating cost is going to be less than a quarter of what it was for the smaller ships. Also, bigger ships can hold more fuel. They can sail further. Well, that only works if you have the economies of scale, both in production and consumption, to justify ships of that size. And we have had that until recently. But now as we break down the system, having large, slow-moving vessels no longer makes sense for systems where we're going to have more co-location between production and consumption. And if you go from larger ships to smaller ships, they're not going to have the range. So everything that is inhibiting manufacturing or mass production or safety on the seas is going to force ships to get smaller and faster and not sail as far. And that alone is enough to break global economies of scale.
Something else that the order maintained peace around the world is our Navy patrolled the world, making it safer for shipping. One of the things that we've seen, and we're seeing this with oil right now, is piracy. Because if you don't have a large Navy, I think at one time at our peak, we had over 600 ships in the U.S. Navy patrolling the globe. We have half of that today, and probably going to have less even going forward. So what about piracy, and what does that do?
The U.S. Navy of the day is designed for the high globalization era. It's not so much that we've got fewer ships. It's that we have bigger ships. We now have 12 aircraft carrier battle groups, and each carrier has a support fleet of, depending on the circumstances, a half a dozen to two dozen vessels, which means that while we've got these giant fleets anchored with the supercarriers that can go and like bomb or destroy any other Navy, they only can guard 12 spots at a time. So the old system where we were a little nervous after World War II about who was going to be shooting at what, and when we needed global commerce to work, we did have more ships, but they were much smaller ships, and so they could be in more places. It's not so much that our Navy has weakened. In fact, it's from a combat point of view, it's so much stronger than it's ever been. But it can only be strong in the places that the carriers are at any given moment. And that's limited. Trade flows everywhere. And we no longer have a naval posture or order of battle, if you will, that is capable of seeing every ship safely to every location. And the United States Navy is significantly more powerful and significantly longer reach than everyone else's Navy. So it's not like there's anyone else who can step into this role. So if we're moving into a world where countries start using economic warfare as a tool, like say the Russians are doing in the Black Sea right now, you get portions of the world's oceans that became basically a no-go zone for civilian shipping. They can't do it safely. They might get caught. They might be disabled. And in that sort of environment, piracy reigns supreme. Right now, the only piracy zone we really have is off of East Africa. But in the world to come, West Africa doesn't look good either. Neither does Southeast Asia. I'd be very worried about anything trying to be in the Eastern Mediterranean. And that's before you get the, quote, real, unquote, naval powers involved on their own in order to secure the resources or the products that they need. I can see India getting very much into state piracy. I can see the French and the Japanese doing the same thing to a degree. It's a tool for getting access to the things that aren't normally in your network. And if you break down the global system, there's going to be a lot of places that simply cannot sustain an industrial economy without some degree of raiding. And it's going to become the norm in large portions of the world.
Let's talk about the implications of slower or no growth on the financial structures, especially of indebted countries, including the U.S., because every politician, at least here in the U.S., they always run, hey, we're going to make your life better. We're going to produce economic growth. What happens when politicians can no longer deliver that growth?
Well, part of that is going to be the breakdown of the social and economic models that we discussed earlier. Probably the best example is going to be the socialist model. And I'm not talking about what the American rightists think socialism is, which is anything where there's a government force in the economy. I'm thinking more of the European flavor of socialism, where they strive for a balance between public and private interests. And there's a degree of government involvement throughout the economy. And the debate is over how deep that penetration should be. In socialism, one of the major goals is a degree of economic equality between the haves and the have-nots, in order to purchase, in essence, a degree of social quietude. I'm not saying that this is bad. I'm not saying this is good. I'm saying this works for some countries. But again, it assumes that the system is getting a little bit, it assumes that the economy is getting a little bit bigger every year. When it's clear that's moving in the other direction, socialism already could not generate as much economic growth as a more capitalist model. And when it comes to the pie shrinking, yes, you might be able to maintain your degree of social equality. But when the system gets worse every single year, socialism breaks down. You start getting corruption as people try to evade the system completely. And in a situation of demographic collapse, when the consumption model is already changing, you're talking about large numbers of older people who suddenly get pushed out into the cold. It will collapse. And in that environment, it really doesn't matter what the politicians do, because there's not going to be a functional system to work on. Now, one of the fun things about North America is the United States has the healthiest demography in the rich world, and Mexico has the healthiest demography in the advanced industrial world. And so together in NAFTA, it's an almost unstoppable force. Both countries are aging, but we're not going to be in a situation in the worst case scenario like the Germans or the Japanese for at least another 35 to 40 years. So we get to continue with our current models for a few more decades, and we get to watch the rest of the world struggle with this. I hope we learn a few things.
Let's combine two questions into one. And one is the map of oil, which today, if you look at oil producers, it's the Middle East, Russia, and U.S. and North America. And where you talk about, given this, that the price of oil is more likely to head up to 150, maybe higher for the rest of the world. But tie into that, Peter, the green revolution, because the green, as you point out in your book, doesn't work on much of the Earth's surface.
Yeah, the energy map of the future is going to be complicated, but there are a couple major trend lines to follow. First of all, a lot of the agony and angst and struggle of the globalized era was about making sure that the energy could make it from where it was produced to where it was consumed. They're inconveniently far apart in most cases. So the Russians send energy to Europe, the Middle Easterners send energy to the East Asian countries, and the United States is a late comer to this. We didn't become a significant player in international energy until the shale revolution came out. And now we're importing really low quality crude from the wider world and exporting high quality crude to the rest of the world, along with a whole lot of refined product. It's a degree of integration that really makes sense because each crude grade is a little bit different and refineries all have their own preference that they're tooled for. You can change that, but then that just locks you into a different crude quality system. Now, you break down transport, and the longer haul transport becomes more dangerous. Well, the longest crude run in the world starts in the Persian Gulf and goes to Northeast Asia. And it sails by a number of countries on the way that don't think very highly of the People's Republic of China. So you can count on that run just not happening to the scale that it has been before. There are some countries who will be able to convoy some energy in some direction. I think the French and the Brits are going to do fine with West Africa. I think the Turks are going to de facto take over Suez and a lot of the Middle Eastern stuff. And in the case of Japan, they can come to the Western Hemisphere. But for everybody else, you're looking at a much darker future where they can't get the energy that they need. I'm sorry, where they can't get the oil that they need. Natural gas is a little messier because it has to have a piped system or a series of liquefaction facilities if you want to ship it by water. That makes it eminently disruptible, because if you break a pipe, if there's a 5,000-mile pipe and you break it in one place, the whole thing goes down. And that makes it very difficult to have piped transmission among countries that don't trust each other. So once again, the Russian system just stops. But the North American system more or less looks okay. So if we're looking at natural gas disruption and we're looking at oil disruption, these are the two fuels that are internationally traded because they can be. There is a third fossil fuel that you can use to power things. It's called coal. And almost every country has it in abundance at home. We are perfectly capable as a species of having economic breakdown and dislocation at the same time we have higher carbon output into the atmosphere. For a lot of the world, that's exactly where we're going.
Now, what about this green revolution? As you point out, you know, along the West Coast of California, we've got sunshine, we've got wind. It works here. I'm not sure in the middle of Michigan or Nebraska where you have snow, or in Seattle where you have cloud cover and rain, that it works there.
In places where you have enough sun, you can make a good start. Just keep in mind that the sun has never once shone at night. And in the case of, say, Southern California, primary energy demand is between 6 p.m. and 9 p.m., which means in half the year, you're talking about peak demand is in a period where the sun is not shining at all. So can solar be part of California's energy mix moving forward and still be economically viable? Absolutely. But it still needs a parallel energy system to provide peak demand power without any input from the sun. That means that California lies a little bit about their carbon emissions because they have to import power from other states to cover that period. And in California statistics, what they import from other states goes down as carbon neutral because it's not, the carbon is emitted on the other side of a state line. They kind of lie. You said some bad things about Nebraska, and I never want to say a good thing about Nebraska, but it is one of the best places in the country for wind. The advantage of wind is that the wind does blow at night. And we now have turbines that are in excess of 700 feet tall, which are now tapping stronger and more reliable wind currents. And so there's a number of places in the Great Plains, basically North Dakota and Iowa, going straight south into Texas, that are able to generate baseload capacity just off of wind. And in places where these two zones, the sun of the southwest and the wind of the Great Plains, roughly overlap, you are looking at metros that might actually be able to go 100% carbon free. Those would be places like Denver, Dallas-Fort Worth, El Paso, Albuquerque. That's great. Doesn't work like that everywhere else. I live at 7,500 feet outside of Denver. I have solar panels that generate most of the electricity that I need. But if I was to put those same solar panels near Toronto, they would only generate about 18% of power. The technology is not something that is universally applicable. Now, there's talk about, say, using batteries to kind of square the circle and cameling water. But as long as we are stuck with lithium, we can only go so far. Building an hour of lithium storage is very expensive. It costs more typically than the power system necessary to sustain the entire system just for that 1 hour of storage. Building 4 hours of storage would cost four times as much. And if you really want to go carbon free, you don't need 4 hours of storage. You need 4 months of storage so you can camel power from the summer into the winter. There's not enough lithium on the planet for the United States to do that, much less the wider world. And this is reflected in what individual cities have done. People think of California as green and mean, but in reality, they only have 1 minute of power storage because the technology, the material science, just isn't there yet.
I want to talk about probably one of the scariest things in your book. In fact, it's, as you mentioned, it's one of the things that keeps you up at night, food production and famine. Let's go there next.
Yeah, that's a dark one. When we think of internationalization of economics, we think of energy, we think of manufacturing. We should think of food. Agriculture is the most vulnerable sector. If you have a financial breakdown, countries or farmers can't borrow in order to get their seed and their inputs. If you have a manufacturing breakdown, they can't get the equipment that they need. If you have an energy breakdown, they can't fuel their equipment, nor can you make several types of fertilizer any longer. If you have a transport breakdown, you can't get things to, from where they are produced to where they need to be consumed, whether it's the things that produce the food or the food itself. Any breakdown in any part of the world, in any economic sector, immediately cascades to agriculture. And if you have a disruption in agriculture that lasts 3 months, you have to wait to the next planting season to start over. And in the meantime, you just don't produce food. We're at the early stages of that right now with the Ukraine war. We're going to see it an order of magnitude more powerfully in the next couple of years as countries decouple and the inputs that are necessary to grow food just can't make it. Only about 20% of food is actually internationally traded, but over 80% of the inputs that allow that food to be produced are traded internationally. And only one of the entire constellation has to break down for the farmers not to be able to do their work. We are incapable in a deglobalized world of sustaining the population that we have now. The best case outcome, assuming significant technological advance to increase yields, the best case outcome is that 1 billion people are going to starve.
I want to talk about something in the news now. You talked about it in your book, 2014, Accidental Superpower, and that's the war in Ukraine. How does this play into this, as you predicted almost a decade ago?
Oof. Well, the reason the war happened is because the Russians feel that if they can't get a more secure border system, that they won't be able to maintain their system because their population is in collapse. That is a correct assessment. Unfortunately, getting to the territories that they think are more defensible in order to plug geographic access points requires them occupying and determining the fate of a number of countries with a combined population of twice of their own. So this war always had to happen, and we always had to resist it. And here we are. From an economic point of view, Russia has taken actions that are have the end result of removing a lot of the former Soviet space from the global system. So we have one of the world's seven major regions that suddenly is not integrated like it used to be. And with every passing day, it becomes less integrated. This has different outcomes on different industries. For example, oil. This was the world's second largest source of crude, and we're looking at several million barrels of crude falling off the market before the end of the year. Could happen as early as this summer. That is going to be the single largest shock to energy markets ever, far worse than what happened with the Arab oil embargoes. Look at it from a manufacturing point of view. The Russians are responsible for the single largest source of intermediate iron products, pig iron basically, which is going to cause massive shortages in the inputs in more advanced countries who use that intermediate product to make their end steel. That affects U.S. construction. They are the world's largest source of neon, which is used in the lasers that make semiconductors. And the facilities that do that are either offline or already destroyed in the war, which means we have to figure out later this year which sectors we don't need digitized anymore. We're going to have to go back to analog in a whole lot of things. And then, of course, the Russians are the world's largest exporter of fertilizer and fertilizer inputs, which brings that famine period forward to the point that it probably starts in the fourth quarter of this year.
I want to bring something up. In your book, you say of the countries that make it through, the U.S. is at the top of the heap. We have the least fallout from this transition. There's another gentleman out there. He runs the largest hedge fund in the world. He's got a new book about the rise and fall of empires. And I'd like you to respond. In his case, the U.S. declines as a superpower because of our moral decay, political dissension, massive debt, in fact, even and the wealth gap, and even goes on to say that perhaps an 80% chance of either civil war or revolution. And this is Ray Dalio's new book on empires. And then he cites the rise of China as the next superpower. How would you counter that?
I would say that in Dalio's first big interview on his book, he showed his cards. He said one of the reasons he's so impressed by China is because he's put most of his money there. And that's the end of the story, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. Let's talk about, given this transition, which you think it's probably going to take about two decades. I think it's 2040 that we work these issues out. Have you ever thought of writing your next book of how we transition or deal with what you see coming?
That is definitely the next big challenge, not just for us, or not just for me, but for us as a country. The United States is moving to some uncharted territory that is going to feel very unfamiliar. We're going to see basically lots of the world burn, and we're going to have some internal debates about what to do about that and what that's going to trigger. We're doing this at the same time we're going through an internal political transition where the factions that make up our parties are just moving around. There's an undiscovered country out there that the United States is going to be able to discover over the course of the next 25, 30 years. And in that time window, we're going to see on the front end the disintegration of the Chinese and the Russian systems. So the major threats that we have been schooling ourselves to prepare for are just going to go away on their own, even without deglobalization. They're both breaking for reasons demographic, financial, and economic. You throw in deglobalization and they fall a lot faster. We have to redesign a lot of our system, whether it's from an environmental point of view or a political point of view. And we have to roughly double the size of our industrial plant in just the next 5 years, unless we don't want to have manufactured products, which I think is unreasonable. That's going to keep us very, very busy. And that is going to provide a lot of inflation in the short term and a lot of disinflation and stability in the long term. And so we're going to get on the backside of this in probably 2030, 2035, and we're going to look around and we're going to realize that we don't recognize the world anymore. And that will be the time for a new generation of American power to interact on fundamentally different terms. But we have a lot of stuff we need to figure out before we get to that point.
Final question, if I may. Is there anything that would reverse your thesis given the demographics as they presently stand?
We would have to have a new technology of transport that changes how we interact with our environment and with our geography. That's a very rare thing. There have only been four technological revolutions in human history. The agricultural revolution that moved us into sedentary agriculture, the deep water revolution in the 1500s that allowed the world to interact regardless of distance because we could now sail with confidence anywhere, the Industrial Revolution, which increased our capacity to generate energy from beyond the old tyrannies of wind and water and muscle, and now possibly the Digital Revolution, although I'm going to say that the jury is still out on that one, because it's not clear it fundamentally changes our interaction with our geography unless we can maintain the interconnected nature of the digital age. You cut a few cables under the ocean and that just goes away. So I'm not sure that's as transformative as a lot of people think. But we would have to have something on the scale of those revolutions that allow us to consume without people and to transport without risk. I don't see anything that's at the prototype stage yet that promises to do that. And with every year that we don't have that revolution, the global demography gets a little older and a little more dysfunctional. So there is a bit of a race here, but we have no idea where the finish line is.
Well, I can tell you, Peter, I've read every single one of your books. I've always found them to be prescient, and this is probably the most prescient I've seen you write. And I guess maybe it's because we see many of the same things that you do, but from an energy and economic point of view. Let's tell our listeners when this book is going to be available. It's called The End of the World is Just the Beginning, Mapping the Collapse of Globalization. by Peter Zion. And Peter, it's my understanding this is available June 14th everywhere?
June 14th. It was supposed to be available in early May, but there was a paper shortage due to supply chain issues. So June 14th, it's already printed and on the way to your favorite bookstore.
Well, it's been one of the favorite books and one of the best I've read in the last couple of years. Congratulations on producing another masterpiece. Well, that concludes my interview with Peter Zion. Once again, the name of Peter's new book, The End of the World is Just the Beginning, Mapping the Collapse of Globalization. And it's well worth the read, and I highly endorse it. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.